Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Some argue a sure sign of forward motion in the global economy would be rising oil prices. But recently, it's been hard to get a clear reading. In the past few weeks, there have been wide swings in the price of oil, despite the fact supplies on hand are more than adequate to meet demand. Joining me to talk about what's behind recent price fluctuations, the role of speculators, and longer-term supply and demand projections, Robinson West. He's with PFC Energy, that's an energy consulting firm. Daniel Juergen of IHS Cambridge Energy Research. And from a studio in New York, John Authors. He's a reporter with the Financial Times. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. And don't forget, we're on Facebook and Twitter. Good morning to all of you, gentlemen. Thank you for joining us. Daniel Juergen, I know that your book, The Prize, The Epic Quest for Oil, Money, and Power, won the Pulitzer Prize when it was first published. Now we are in 2009. Give us a sense of this volatility in oil prices. Just how significant is it?
It is very significant. If you think within a decade, we've had oil as low as $10 a barrel and as high. Just a year ago, we're at the anniversary virtually at $147.27. And it has a big impact. The American automobile industry, the North American automobile industry was not knocked flat on its back by the bankruptcy of Lehman Brothers last September. It was knocked flat on its back by what happened at the gasoline pump. So these swings in price in the world's most important commodity are very important to the overall economics and economic recovery.
Why do you believe they're happening?
I think that it starts, the volatility, I think a lot of it has to do with these fundamental forces of supply and demand. And in the prize, there are thousands of characters, and I think the two most important characters are supply and demand. We had the 5 years of the best economic growth we'd had in a generation. Tight oil markets resulted. Then I think a lot of other things piled on top of it. Geopolitics, from Nigeria to Iraq to Venezuela. Doubling of costs in the oil field. And then the integration of oil with financial markets and the way that oil has become a financial asset that, for instance, somebody with a who's managing your pension fund says, well, you've got to be in stocks, bonds, but you've got to be in commodities too. And suddenly it's a financial asset as well.
Daniel Juergen, author of The Prize, The Epic Quest for Oil, Money, and Power. Robin West, what do you see happening to the price of oil and why?
Well, I think I agree with Dan that there's some important forces, but one of the forces, more recent events, Dan puts it very well in historic context, but first you've got the state of the economy, and there's tremendous uncertainty in the economy right now. Secondly, one of the things that's happened in the last year is that spare capacity in OPEC has gone up very dramatically from about 2 million barrels a day, where the world oil market was on a knife edge, to now over 6 million barrels. So there's a lot of oil sloshing around, and that depends on OPEC discipline. The third point that Dan pointed out is that there is a shift from oil from being an industrial commodity to run your car or your factory to becoming a financial instrument. This really happened since 2004. And then finally, there's this fundamental belief in a long-run capacity constraint that's going to occur, that eventually demand will exceed supply. And so that there's this underpins, this narrative tends to drive the market as well. So there are four powerful factors in that.
And turning to you now, John, author of the Financial Times, to what extent did you see the price of oil follow the same kind of bubble pattern as other assets, including in the financial, the housing markets?
Certainly last year. I mean, obviously, oil was already very much in a bull market for all the standard fundamental reasons that we've been talking about going into last year. But certainly what you saw last year was in many ways a very direct offshoot of the bubble conditions that we've all been discussing, particularly, as you said, in the housing market. You had this situation where you saw obvious severe problems for the banking sector, for housing. You saw a big range of investors were investing in oil through a range of new financial products that really hadn't been open to them before. And they had the opportunity to use this as a hedge against the weakening dollar. Oil is a hard asset if you're worried that the dollar is going to weaken, particularly as oil is denominated in dollars. Buy oil as a hedge against the dollar getting weaker. Lots of people, with good reason, thought that was a risk early last year, so they piled into oil. And similarly, if you're worried about inflation, if you want to make a hedge against inflation, you pile into oil. It was something that had not really been possible to the same extent before. And so you did see a succession of different bubbles. The internet bubble was followed by cheap money and the housing bubble. And in many ways, once the housing bubble burst and the attempt to deal with that problem started, the response was to inflate the final, the final push from say $80 or $90 up to $147 was in many ways an expression of the final attempt to the final bubble of that sequence. And it was in many ways, it was once the oil bubble sort of burst under its own weight a year ago that the market began to collapse under its own contradictions. People had been betting that the U.S. economy was in extreme trouble, and yet the oil price was going to keep going up.
John Authors, he is a reporter for the Financial Times. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Dan Juergen in this morning's Wall Street Journal. Gordon Brown, the Prime Minister of the UK, and Nicolas Sarkozy, President of France, have co-written a piece about the risks of oil price volatility. What do you see as the risks? I know you were very involved with the two men as they wrote.
Right. Well, it was certainly part of it with Prime Minister Brown last December, when they refer to the conference where they address these questions. I think that they're looking at the question of how do you assure stable supplies at relatively stable prices. And when you have this extreme volatility that we've seen, it not only affects your economy, but it makes it very hard to make long-term investments. But they're struggling with it because in that letter they say, we know it's a hard problem and we're not quite sure what to do about it, but they're saying it is a problem. And I think it's inevitable after this kind of price movement we've seen, that there's going to be a new, not only U.S., but global scrutiny of how the pricing system works, and trying to do it, whether it's in a G8 or a G20 framework, it's just inevitable.
How does the pricing system work?
That's a big question. But basically, the prices, what you have price revealed in what goes on in the futures markets, that's where the buying and selling and all the prices from around the world come together. But what we've seen, and Robin referred to this, was this disconnection between what was actually happening in the physical marketplace and what was happening in the financial marketplace. It was so bizarre last July and June, the prices going up. We could see the U.S. is going into recession. We can see demand going down and prices going up. And I think that something else that comes out of what both Robin and John were saying is that as I've reflected on this over the last year, I've really come to see, there is a belief system. There was this belief system. The world is running out of oil. China is going to drink every last barrel of oil in the world. And by the way, the U.S. can go into a deep recession and China, India, and Europe will go on having high economic growth. That was the belief system. And people just drove on that belief system right over the cliff.
Where did that belief system originate? Why don't we start with you, John Authors?
Well, I mean, your other guests can tell you more about it. It's often popularly known as peak oil. At some point, the world supply of oil will peak and steadily start to lower. That's an argument that geologists can discuss. But obviously, at some point, it will come. The problem you get, it's a classic problem with any other that you share with any other financial bubble, is that the market can start to reinforce perceptions, and those perceptions can then reinforce the market. Oh, look, the oil price is going up. So investors go, therefore, that means oil supply really has peaked. We really are running out of oil, so let's buy more. That pushes the price up further and further convinces people. There are huge, fascinating arguments about whether we're bumping up against supply constraints for oil globally. The point is that last year they didn't suddenly become so much stronger that the oil price needed to double in a matter of months. That was a question of the interplay of perception of the market with perceptions of reality.
John Authors, he's a reporter for the Financial Times. Here in the studio, J. Robinson West, chairman of PFC Energy, and Daniel Yergin, author of The Prize. Short break, right back. Joining us now is Bart Chilton of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. Good morning to you, sir. Thanks for joining us.
Sure, Diane. Good to be with you.
Thank you. Tell us about the action the Commodity Futures Trading Commission is thinking about taking.
I think what we're going to do is hold some hearings this summer, and the hearings will be on whether or not we should finally put some mandatory limits on the amount of futures contracts that an individual trader can hold. As your guests were talking about earlier, this speculative activity in the last year helped to drive prices up. In fact, there was over $200 billion, Diane, that came into the futures market in the last several years. And most of us think that had some upward price movement. And we think that at some point enough is enough, and that we've got to put a cap on that investment into the futures markets.
So explain how you would do that. You would actually impose limits on the number of futures contracts in oil and other energy commodities that are held by speculative traders.
Yeah, exactly right. I also think we need to look at the metals, by the way. But with regard to oil, absolutely. It's sort of unbelievable, Diane, that right now the limits are more like suggested speed limits. They're not mandatory caps. They call them accountability levels. And traders regularly just pass over these accountability levels, and they can control a significant portion of the market. If not as an individual trader, which is something that we look at every day to make sure that a trader isn't manipulating the market with such a high position, but in the aggregate, this new class of investors that Mr. Yergin was talking about, these speculators who are looking for a new place to put investments, in the aggregate, a lot of people think, like the tide, that rose the price of oil and other commodities, and that's what we're going to try to get a handle on to protect consumers.
But explain to me how you're going to differentiate between an investor and a speculator.
Well, what we already do, and we don't do it well enough, Diane, it's a great question, but what we already do is separate the traders between commercial traders and non-commercial. The commercials are people that have some interest in the underlying commodity. So if you're a gas station or an oil refiner, but not if you're simply an investor. So we separate the commercials from the non-commercials. But we really need to further delineate those categories to ensure we have a better handle on who these people are, who these traders are, who they represent. And then we can decide what limits are appropriate for those individual categories. But that's part of why we're doing these hearings, to make sure that we get this right. And it's also why I think programs like yours today are very helpful in that regard.
Let me understand the evidence that you seem to have, or whether you do have evidence that speculators were actually major players in the market and driving up the price of oil in the past few years.
Well, the use of the word driving up is debatable. Most people, I think, would agree they had some impact. But whether or not they were driving it, people will disagree. Certainly supply and demand had a lot to do with it last year, as well as many of the other fundamentals that your guests have been talking about, geopolitics, refining capability, value of the dollar, other world currencies, et cetera. But it just seems to us that, there's enough evidence out there that this $200 billion that came into the system, consumers certainly felt like they got kicked in the teeth with oil prices last year. This is such an important commodity. It's not our job as a U.S. regulator to set prices, Diane, but it is our job to ensure that there's nothing nefarious going on in these markets and that it's a fair price. And that's what we're going to try to do through these hearings and through this rulemaking process.
Here's an email from Alan in Columbia, Maryland, on that very point. He says, "I'm stumped. The last time oil prices soared, we were told oil speculators were largely to blame. Yet when the market collapsed, who ever heard of such investors losing big money? Where is that money going, Bart?"
Well, matter of fact, Diana, it's a great question from Al, because a lot of people who had doubts about whether or not speculators were having an influence when the prices went up changed their tune when they saw speculators leaving the market and the price going down as the bubble burst that you were talking about. So a lot of that money is on the sidelines right now looking for places to go. And I think that's why you saw oil start to run back up this year. It was an early indicator of places for people to put money. In fact, already this year, we saw oil went up 60%. Now, it's gone down in the last week or so, but it went up 60% this year, Diane. And that's with, as Daniel Yergin said, the highest supply and the lowest demand that we've had in 10 years. And that just sort of baffles our 8th grade civics classes. It shouldn't be happening. So something else is going on in these markets, and we think one way to address it is to put on some limits on the amount of investment people can make into these markets, an appropriate limit. We certainly need speculators in these markets. It's just we don't want them to be having some uneconomic impact, something that's not based upon supply and demand.
Daniel Yergin, you had a question.
Yes, I'm sure you struggle with it, but the term speculator means many different things to many different people. Could you differentiate between the kind of technical meaning of speculator in a futures market and kind of this more general use of the term? And the other question that goes with it is, do you think that if there's just greater clarity about who's who in this market, that in itself would help people understand what's going on?
Absolutely, Daniel. I think, you know, one of the things we're trying to do is not only get this information ourselves so we better understand it, so we can have the right tool to fix the problem, if there is one, but also greater transparency for the public, for people like you and your jobs, but also, you know, just average folks out there who want to understand what's going on with this very important commodity. So, you know, I should mention that there are places that even if we seek to get more information, we won't be able to do so. There are over-the-counter markets, as your guests know, Diane. A lot of people call those dark markets. They can have an impact on the regulated markets, which is based is what people, that's how gas prices are evolved. And in addition, there's foreign markets. There's a market in London. There's markets other places in the world. And this is a global commodity now. And so it's incumbent upon us to work with our brethren regulators around the world to ensure that we're getting this right so that we're protecting consumers while continuing to have vibrant, efficient, and effective markets.
I think Robin West has a question.
Yeah, it also, $200 billion coming into the market is a lot of money. But if you look at global markets, global capital markets, they've all expanded enormously. And as John Authors pointed out, there is a connection between the oil markets as a financial instrument and the, frankly, and the dollar. And there's a very high inverse correlation between the dollar and the price of oil. When the dollar goes up, the price of oil tends to go down, vice versa. I mean, it seems to me there are other forces that are perfectly straightforward and are just used as financial tools. And it seems to me the Commission's got to be very careful as it intervenes in markets that it doesn't upset some other, frankly, fairly rational mechanisms in the market.
Bart?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with you, Robin. I mean, there are absolutely other things that we need to be looking at. And again, our job is not to be a price setter. We shouldn't be saying that gas has to be, you know, $2.50. But we should protect consumers to ensure that they know that they're getting a fair deal, that we're avoiding any fraud, abuse, or manipulation in these markets. And that's why we're having these hearings, and that's why programs like this are so important. And I really appreciate you shedding some light on this, Diane, and your great guests are very helpful to me, in addition, I'm sure, to your audience.
I think John Authors has a question.
Well, I'd like to make one quick point. If it makes your email messenger from Columbia, Maryland feel any better, I know lots of people who lost an awful lot of money when the oil price started to go down last July, and a lot of hedge funds took a really awful bath there. So, I mean, a lot of the people who made money on the way up did indeed lose a lot of money on the way down. Yeah. I think the central question I have, the circumstantial evidence, it seems to me, is overwhelming that the influx of money to futures and the expansion of institutional interest from pension funds and in exchange traded funds, the circumstantial evidence that has had some effect is extremely strong. It still seems to me that we it's elusively difficult to nail down exactly how it's had an effect, how it works, what the CFTC needs to do to address the problem. I totally agree that this is a discussion we need to have, that it's an issue that's vitally important. What evidence do we have at the moment that there is a clear-cut causal effect? What exactly do you need to do to the regulations to avoid perverse responses or unforeseen consequences when you make a change to the regulations?
Yeah, well, I mean, there are studies out there. I believe there's a Harvard study, and there's several more that will suggest that they'll try to quantify the rise from last year in oil, and some have suggested 20-30%. People testified on Capitol Hill and said as much as 50%. I don't know if those are right or not, because as you say, this is so elusive, and a lot of these markets we can't see. As I mentioned, the international markets, the dark markets in the U.S. So it's a complicated thing. But I think most of your listeners, Diane, would agree that at some point, enough is enough when you control a significant portion of a market. I don't know what that magic number or percentage is. If it's 20%, 30%, 51%, but at some level, it seems to me, as a regulator who's charged with protecting consumers, we have to say, that's all you can acquire.
All right. I have one last question for you, and this is from Matthew in North Carolina, who says, respectfully, your guest is being absurd. Is there a limit to how much GM stock I can buy? How much government debt? How many bananas? Let us be frank. More people are investing in commodities as a hedge against inflation to steal the ability of hardworking Americans to protect their assets against a devaluing dollar is to mandate their exposure to inflationary losses and absolutely unacceptable.
Well, with all due respect to the person, I disagree. I mean, it just seems to me that if you ask consumers whether or not these markets were functioning properly last year, they'd say a big heck no. And at some level, in my view, we just have to say you can't control more than that. And so we're going to do the best we can. We're going to listen to everybody, including those that disagree with us. And hopefully we're going to strike the right balance to ensure that we get these markets running efficiently and effectively.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Daniel Juergen, you have another question.
Yeah, for the commissioner.
Yes.
If he could sort out that powerful word, speculator, that has everything. You mentioned testifying in front of Congress, and I certainly noted that it's everything from a technical word describing a person who plays a particular role in a financial to implying a manipulator and a whole host of things. Can you just sort out kind of the definitions of speculator and how you look at that
it's
word?
It's a powerful word,
yes.
Indeed.
It is, and it's really undefined in statute to the way I think it should be. The term excessive speculation is one that is bandied about in Energy Circle and on Capitol Hill, and that's exactly what we're trying to do, is to find what that means. What is that level at which it becomes excessive? And certainly speculators shouldn't be seen as robber barons or anything of the sort. They are a needed, essential component to these markets, which have worked well for 100 years. But every once in a while, laws, rules, and regulations need some tweaks. And in this case, what we're thinking about doing, Diane, is merely putting some sideboards on this road to the future. And I think that with the help of the public and people like your guest, we're going to get it right, and we're going to ensure that these markets operate efficiently and effectively and that we protect consumers.
Robin West.
Yeah, I'd like to follow up on Dan Juergen's point. Isn't really the key issue the ability not to speculate but to manipulate? And if you have such a big piece of the market, you can then manipulate the market. That's the real danger. But it does seem to me that the one thing that is absolutely critical is to be able to have really a global transparency of these markets. Until you understand this is a global commodity and it's traded around the world.
And by transparency, what you mean is who is holding?
How much?
How much?
Yeah.
And how do you find that out?
Well, I think that they would have to report that, or the markets themselves would have to report
and
that.
And what you're saying is that right now that's not being done.
That is not being done on a global basis, and that's really what's necessary.
And Bart Chilton, do you agree with that?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Matter of fact, there's very little in your program that I would disagree with. I think it is a global commodity. We need to work on it. We need to have greater transparency, and we need to ensure that it's not just the individual trader who could amass an amount that could manipulate a market. It could be an unintentional manipulation, Diane, by a group of traders. This is these new speculators that have come in, and who these are, by the way, they're endowments they're pension funds, they're hedge funds. They're people who Mr. Juergen spoke about early in the program that traditionally haven't invested in the commodities markets. They've been at other places. They've been in bonds. They've been in securities. But they're looking at this, the commodities market, as a new asset class in their investment portfolio. And so what they do is they make this investment and they keep it long term, Diane. So they're not in it for the next 6 months like traders have traditionally been in these markets. They're in it as an investment class portfolio for the long term, and that could inadvertently have some impact in manipulating the market. And again, not necessarily a technically unlawful manipulation, but just rising all of the costs, just like the tide would rise all boats. And that's what we're concerned about.
All right. Bart Chilton, he's commissioner for the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Diane.
Short break. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. By the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And by the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
If so much information and so many downloads on the internet are free, how is it possible to make money? On the next Fresh Air, Wired magazine editor-in-chief Chris Anderson talks about internet businesses that have made a profit by giving things away. His new book is called Free. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And welcome back. We're talking about the fluctuation in oil prices, whether it's being caused by speculators, and that word has yet to be clearly defined, and what we can expect next. Here's an email from Jeff in Kensington, Maryland, who says, for you to claim you do not understand why oil rose from its post-bubble low of $33 to its current $62 price gives this citizen concern that you do not understand markets. The $200 billion that came into the oil market, pushing prices to artificial highs of $147, exited and pushed prices to artificial lows of $33. Markets which overshoot on the upside, undershoot on the downside. Don't bubble markets always act this way, Robin?
Markets do tend to self-correct, but I think it's important to point out that if you go back to oil the way we used to think of it as an industrial commodity, where you have the question, the fundamentals of supply and demand. Frankly, the fundamentals do not support this price now. That is the view of people in the industry. And so there are obviously other forces that are driving the price up. Yes, as I say, bubbles tend to self-correct, but fundamentals should matter, and they've certainly mattered in the past. And since oil is so important to the economy, that's why the issue of fundamentals comes back.
Dan Yergin.
Yes, I think that, the paper we wrote for the conference with Gordon Brown was called Recession Shock, and we're still in a recession shock. You look at all the indicators, instead of a very tight market, as Robin said, we have this very large overhang of oil. I think what was happening here is, I think the point that John Authors made is one that really needs to be reiterated, that this kind of inverse relationship between dollar and oil price is very strong and very recurrent. We used to have a flight to dollar during times of instability. Now we have a flight to oil and other commodities during a time of dollar instability. The other thing was it went back to the psychology. A month ago, we were into the green shoots. We were into recovery. We were into inflation coming. And all of that was, where to be. But commodities, it was like oil was a barometer, not of where the world economy is now, but where people thought it was going to be at the end of the year. It's now receded, and we've seen it come down as people are getting more sober about the economic outlook. But it is this aspect of oil as a financial commodity.
All right, let's go to Sun City, California. Good morning, Bill. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. The fundamental thing that I'm hearing is that people are puzzled and don't know what's happening, and I think that is because there's a fundamental flaw in the premise. And that is that the price of gasoline is driven by the price of oil. Well, that can only happen when the buyer has to pay what the seller demands. And that's clearly not true in the oil and gasoline market. The refiners are the people that buy the oil from the producers. And the refiners sell it to the service station, who sell it to the American driver. And the American driver doesn't have to pay a price based on what the oil producer is charging. He only has to pay what he has to pay at the pump.
John Authors, do you want to comment?
I certainly think that you can't draw a straight line between crude oil prices and gasoline prices at the pump. Bear in mind, crude oil prices are significant for very many areas of industrial activity beyond the gas that we put into our cars here in the U.S. I'd like to make one point, if I may, just catching up on the this very loaded and often very pejorative word, speculator.
Sure.
If I can help with the classical definition, the difference between a speculator and an investor, apart from whether you feel like being rude to that individual or being polite to them, the classical definition is that a speculator is making a bet on how other people in the market will respond. You're speculating if you're thinking, I don't actually think it's worth this much, but I think there are going to be greater fools who pay even more, and on that basis I am going to buy. Whereas an investor is investing on the basis of what they see as some fundamental value, that you're making a bet about the value of the asset rather than about the behavior of your fellow investors or speculators. As I think has been pointed out, the word speculator can be used, but it has a pejorative overtone. We do need to bear in mind we're talking about the people who entered this market are largely public pension funds, large foundations, and they were acting on the basis of research which came out primarily out of Yale, showing that if they were to add commodities to their stocks and bonds, they would get the same return for less risk. Obviously, that turned out to be disastrously wrong in the latter half of last year, but there was reputable academic research pushing a bunch of very large conservative organizations whose aim is to help widows and orphans.
All right.
They may have been speculators in some sense, but let's be very careful about the pejorative terms here.
Okay, let's go to Omatilla, Oregon. Good morning, Stephen. You're on the air.
Thank you, Diane. My question is, if an oil company had excess dollars and excess oil, can they, in fact, manipulate the price in the dark markets?
Dan, you're again.
Well, I think it's the people you'd have to look to are the financial players. There was a theory that when he was still in power, that Saddam Hussein would take positions in the futures market and then create a problem with the UN. This seems like another era when he would do that, and the price of oil would go up, and he would put some more money into his coffers. You have to keep in mind that over 80% of the world's oil reserves are controlled by these state oil companies of one kind or another, and they're sitting on most of the oil. It's a very big market. It's 83 million barrels a day. So, I guess that's the question the CFTC is going to look at to see, are there people who are in a position actually to, in a sense, corner the market?
All right. And to Durham, New Hampshire. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Diane. At the beginning of the season, new television season last fall, CBS 60 Minutes did a program in which Steve Croft reported that not only was had it gone from speculation to more manipulation, but the largest holder of oil paper in the world at the time when the prices were the highest was Morgan Stanley. Now, let's not just go beat around the bush here, their dark market. I mean, these guys were proven to have this paper. And when you've got the majority, you can manipulate. So I'd like the panel to address that, and I'd love to know why we haven't heard more about them in specifics. Thank you.
Robin.
Well, this has been a debate going on in Washington now for over a year, and there are a number of large securities firms like Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs that they have a very strong view that they're participants in the market, but they're not manipulating the market. There are critics who would argue that these large financial firms are. And this is, frankly, one of the key questions that the CFTC is going to look into. I think, going back to an earlier question, the one group that I think you will find have not been manipulating the market are the oil companies who use these markets solely for their own inventory management purposes. And they don't play in these markets in a big way.
John Authors, do you want to comment?
Well, yes, a few points. First of all, I think this is exactly the kind of critical issue where we want a government agency with subpoena power and all the rest of it to try to get to the bottom of this, because plainly it's very important. More generally, I do think one point to bear in mind is that although a bunch of very big financial institutions had very large positions, and another very important name in this that hasn't been mentioned is AIG, had a very big role in developing this market. A lot of them were holding them through exchange-traded funds, where the whole point of the contractual obligation was to sit there and hold them passively. The idea was that they were offering people a passive involvement in the oil price in the same way that somebody offering an exchange-traded fund tied to the NASDAQ or to the S&P 500 would be undertaking to track that index. So it's not totally clear, even if you do have a very large proportion of the market, that you are actually in a position actively to manipulate it, because you're under a contract to hold it in a certain passive way. You're not; these were not holdings in all cases that those institutions that held them were allowed to buy and sell.
Dan Jurgen, you said that by 2025, global energy consumption will double from today's levels. How much of that is going to be in oil?
At this point, based upon where we are today, we'd say that oil is today about 40% of world energy, and it might be 30% then. But it is, when I was doing the new edition of the prize, I was really thinking about that specific question. And I think one thing that's different now that we really haven't probably ever seen is this focus on innovation and technology all across the energy spectrum. Whether you're talking about conventional energy, we've had these big innovations the last 3 years in U.S. natural gas, to obviously the electric car, to solar photovoltaics. we don't really know what's going to be economic on a large scale. This is still early days, but I think that's a new factor that so that the forecast that's there is kind of the track we're on, assuming we get back on a global good global economic growth track, but it could be changed by what happens on technology.
Robin.
I like to point out that energy is one of those words like love and finance. It means different things to different people. There really are two different energy markets. One is the transportation sector, which is oil and petroleum and other liquids. And then the other sector is the utility sector, which is electricity, which is nuclear, coal, solar, wind, hydropower, and things like that. These really are two different businesses. They may converge over time, as Danny pointed out, with technology, as frankly, as cars reach more to the electron. But the Obama administration has a goal of having 1 million electric cars on the road in the next few years. I should point out there are 251 million cars on the road in the United States. So this is going to take a long time to change. So technology will play a role, but these really are two different businesses, and you have to think of them as such.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And let's go now to Sturgis, Michigan. Good morning, Charlie. You're on the air.
Good morning, and what a pleasure it is to be with your guest today, and also you, Diane.
Thank you.
My comments and questions are threefold. One is I'd like to have your panelists talk a little bit about the new exchange that saw, I believe, just quite a bit of the oil trade go to it. And there was an article about who was behind that exchange and where the money was coming from. My second point is had to do with I really was impressed with the discussion about trying to find limits or put some limits on some of the trading. And I think you see the same kind of thing happening in the other commodities markets where what's happening in the futures and what's happening in the cash market don't agree. And I think the wheat market was a good example of this as well. I'd love to have your panelists talk a little bit about that. I mean, it seems like with the big money that's coming in, you are just not – you know, be careful what you ask for. I mean, exchanges make money when people trade. And when they expand to the limits, I just kind of think that it's not a surprise we're where we are today.
All right. Thanks for calling, Dan Yergin.
Well, these futures markets, the NYMEX is just looking. The prize started in the 1870s as the egg, butter, and cheese exchange. Then it became the potato exchange. Then there was a problem with potatoes failing to pass inspection in New York City. And lo and behold, in 1983, it started trading oil. And then now we've seen this. There's the ICE market. There are others. There's one in Dubai. So these markets continue to evolve. But I was, you know, Diane, as I was reflecting on the comments, listening to the commissioner, and where we are today, that there's the word speculator, as Robin suggests manipulator. And a couple of the questions have pointed that. But if you really think about it, you say the structure of the financial markets around oil have changed a lot since 2004. And I think that's what we need to get a handle on, because it is a different kind of market than it was 4 or 5 years ago. And it may be all of our pension funds and everything like that that are in there, but it does take some understanding of how these have changed.
But do you believe that the Commodity Futures Trading Commission has the right approach to dealing with what's happening and this, not only the potential growth, but where we are right now?
Well, I think Robin has emphasized this is a global issue, that you know, this is truly the global economy, the global commodity. But I think that if there are hearings, if they proceed to say, we really want to understand how these markets, we're not necessarily saying there's a villain that we're going to throw in jail, but we want to understand how the structure of the markets, I think that's the place to start.
But what about the caps that the commissioner talked about?
Well, I think the point that your caller just made, be careful what you wish for, these markets have important economic uses. And I think it's important that we understand the implications of caps if it would work that way. And the other thing, to an earlier call, which I mentioned to you, is that the issue of the volatility of markets moving a lot, people make money when markets go up and down, and that's how traders make money. They don't just make money in up markets.
Dan, you're getting last word.
Right. What need to keep in mind is that these markets, the notion of the speculator, the service they provide is enabling a hedger, an airline or producer or a person with home heating oil business to hedge their price and protect themselves. So that's the way these markets are, that's what they're supposed to be doing.
Well, we're going to be watching, obviously, to see where these markets go, how they go, and how they affect all of us in this economy. Thank you so much, Daniel Yergin. He's chair of IHS Cambridge Energy Research. His book is titled The Prize. Jay Robinson West is chair of PFC Energy. And John Authors is a reporter for the Financial Times. Thank you all so much. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rain.